Now, the traditional sort of World Bank type response has been land titling, and there's major issues with that as a shelter tool, as a pro-poor shelter tool. So-called illegal settlements immediately are excluded from land titling. It's not a pro-poor program, land titling. This is a major technical issue that's very rarely highlighted, and it's a complete bugbear of mine, is that the statistics on land titling in Asia Pacific clearly show that most people who get land title certificates do not record subsequent transactions in that land. So they lease the land, or they die and their heirs take over the land. It's very common. It's very common in sub-Saharan Africa as well. In Cambodia, for all the money spent on land titling, over a million title certificates issued, 10 to 15% of holders of those certificates are registering subsequent transactions in that land. And what that means is that over a 5-10 year period, the land titling records lose any validity whatsoever. Well, they lose a large degree of validity because you can't rely on them. You still have to go to the local area to do your due diligence on who has rights to that land. So what's the point of a land titling program? Why do people not record something? Because it's too expensive. They've got an alternative localised system, often. They don't trust the state. The state is corrupt. And so, it's a political economy analysis of the state. It has to be a big part of the story here. And also, for all the talk about gender-sensitive land titling, the evidence is pretty clearly that that women miss out. And I think the responses are laughable to that empirical fact, because every land titling program I've ever seen says, oh, well, we recognise the risks of gender discrimination. We're going to have education programs and training for land title staff, and we're going to make sure that women can attend these public meetings. But inherent in any land titling process is an opportunity to increase your rights, your legally recognised rights to land, and people take advantage of that, particularly men in this instance. And it's not a neutral process. Nothing to do with land is a socially or politically neutral process. So the Cambodia case study is a paradigmatic example of the problems of land titling. Sure, they issued over a million land title certificates. They have in Indonesia. So I've talked to people who got their land title certificates. They're happy. I don't want to deny that it has some benefits. But what happened was that if the state deemed an area to be state public land, then the land titling would not take place on that area. The land titling agency would not go behind the state declaration. So the state could say, oh no, you can't do that area, it's state land, which is what happened in the famous case. Also, that the agencies that implement these programs, they want quick results, they want numbers, so they, on their own back, it wasn't in the formal documents, they excluded areas where disputes were likely, they got the low-hanging fruit. There's no complementary mapping of state land areas, so the state has a discretion, unchecked largely, to determine which areas are state land. That's the major issue I talked about. And the what we call the derivative registration problem. All right. So this is your standard sort of UN habitat. I'm moving to responses and possible approaches or solutions here. And the general starting point is your UN Habitat tenure ladder or tenure continuum. And I want to make the point clearly that this is largely an advocacy and education tool. It's definitely not a panacea for the reasons I will explain. But it's a nice place to start, and particularly changing the mindset of highly formalistic approaches to land and land tenure. As they generally the notion of land titling is that you go straight to a formalised sort of ownership, but registered freehold. But certainly in the types of examples I've talked about, there is a lot of value in intermediate steps, intermediate approaches. Now, it's not going to be as good as ownership. And I've got this problem in doing some work with Oxfam in, after Typhoon Haiyan, where the question is, what's the recommendation for land tenure for those in informal settlements who won't be relocated? Now, the reality is, they are informal settlers. They will not get registered freehold. And you have to, as organisations, have to make the decision, are we going to advocate for registered freehold where that's never going to happen because legally freehold's in another person's name or in the name of the state? Or are we going to advocate for a lesser form of tenure? And it's a difficult choice. It really is a difficult choice, but my argument is, you know, in these situations, often the perfect is the enemy of the good. And I've had to do this a lot of times, make compromises to try and get an effective result. And sometimes the compromise is essential to get people back into shelter in circumstances of displacement. With my example of Aceh, where, you know, the perfect solution was that people had registered freehold and then you gave them their house. But if that means they live in a tent for 2 years, I don't think that's an acceptable result.